Welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we dispense wisdom, not just information, not mere facts, not mere platitudes to an international audience of rising leaders. In other words, in this podcast, you'll hear valuable insights that you cannot learn from a textbook, because it took us years to learn this stuff. My name is Jeffrey Wang, the founder of the Professional Development Forum and your host. I'm joined today by your producer, Robert Hosry, my co-host, Siba van der Zee, and Diana White. We're also very excited to have Yi Wang in front of the camera for the very first time. Today's podcast is special because we mark a very significant milestone. This is our 100th episode. Considering that about half of all podcasts only have 10 episodes or fewer, this is quite an achievement. Clearly motivated by our love to share wisdom with the world over the past 2 and a bit years. Together, we have spoken to about 100 wise guests, uncovered almost 1,000 lessons. There are some strong themes that have emerged through all of these, and the same lessons were told in very different ways with very different stories. There are lessons that we feel very strongly about, some that we have personally experienced and agree with, as well as others that hasn't worked for us. Today, we're going to have a conversation about these lessons and why we felt so strongly about them. So, let me start with Siba. What are the lessons that you have particularly liked in the whole time that we've been doing 10 lessons?
Yeah, Jeffrey, that's a tough question, right? Because we've had so many great guests with so many great lessons that I really had to go through it very closely. So the first lesson I want to mention is from Dr. Cindy Benton, lesson number 8.
All right. Number 8, challenges and obstacles are excellent opportunities to gain strength and grow.
Ooh, I've had my fair share of challenges and obstacles. I have this sign on my office wall, and it says, God only gives us what we can handle. And the second line says, apparently God thinks I'm a badass. Because I'm a cancer survivor. There were times when financially tried to start my business, I almost went broke. I've survived, company acquisitions and layoffs and things like that. And when you're in those types of situations where the obstacles and challenges are so strong, I change my perspective on things. I go, well, you got nowhere else to go but up. And what did you learn from this? That's the biggest thing, learning from those obstacles and challenges and using that information. I think all the obstacles, and I wouldn't trade it anything. People say, well, you would have cancer again? Well, no, not necessarily. But it showed me a strength and depth within myself that I didn't know I had. And coming out of it, 9 months of chemo and radiation, I felt like I can do anything. This didn't kill me. So it was empowering almost, and it changed my mindset on challenges and obstacles. Not to say that I still don't get in the weeds and go, hey, what's happening? Why me? Why can't things just be smooth? Why do they always have to be? Yeah, I do still get in that. And it's okay. I embrace it and then I come out of it. But I think challenges and obstacles are there for us to learn from. And I know it's cliche to say they make us stronger, but they actually do. It's like the yin and the yang. You got to have the good with the bad. So obstacles and challenges, I welcome them. I really do.
And she gave some great examples and, very sad as well. She suffered from cancer. She had to deal with that, but she learned lessons to overcome that and to deal with that. And I think it's fair to say that obstacles indeed have the potential to make a person better and stronger. And I also want to add in this our good friend Diana White, because she talked in reference to that particular lesson about the relevance of having a mentor. And that's obviously highly appreciated. The next lesson I want to mention is coming from Matt Bai, well-known journalist. Lesson number 6, people always make you feel the way they feel.
So yeah, this is another one I talk to my kids about a lot. So I was at Newsweek, so I was probably in my early 30s. I was traveling around all the time, and I was traveling from one city to another. And I met this woman on a plane, and she's a psychologist. And we got to talking, and as it turned out, as weird things happened, we spent some time together after. She was coming to Washington, where I was living. And she told me something as we were having this discussion. She said, well, the thing is, however people make you feel is generally how they're feeling themselves. So if they make you feel small, it's because the world makes them feel small. If they make you feel dumb, it's because the world is making them feel dumb. And it was such a simple formulation, and it's probably pretty standard for people who study the human psyche, I guess. But it's always stuck with me, and I found it to be very useful in life to remember. In fact, a tremendous example of that to me is President Trump, who I've written about this. I've written columns about this, you know, who makes our politics feel very small and trivial. And I think because he often feels small and trivial, has a fear of that. And so I, for me, it's been very useful to in dealing with people in difficult situations, or just to help me remember that that person is coming from a place of their own weakness and not to take it as personally as I otherwise would.
Again, very good lesson. And I had to think about it because, yes, the way people feel, their personality, their emotions come through. But I also think that is an interesting concept when we want to learn about people. The way people behave, it's not just how they deal with us and communicate with us. It is a way for us to understand where they're coming from. So even when we talk, for example, about empathy, if someone is sad or frustrated, you can pick up on that based on their behavior. So coming from MedBuy, I thought that was a very important lesson. I add from Bashaiki Connor, I thought also very interesting lesson, lesson number 4, learn the old way and then find your own way. My gosh, you know, so much learning, and that's what we're talking about, very helpful. Maybe my favorite, if I can address that as well in this particular session, came from our Native American artist, Jacob Butler. He talked about know your worth.
So I use an example, I guess, in my art. So before I start any type of like new medium, and so for me, like I like to move around in different art forms and I work in different mediums because it keeps things fresh. And for me, the study of that art form is really what gets me excited about things. And so the work that I put into my art, it doesn't just start with me picking up a paintbrush and putting it to canvas or picking up a piece of silver and starting to manipulate it with a chasing tool. It's hours and hours of research before you even get into the actual craft. And so I would go to market, and because I felt that I was not of the degree or standard that some of these artists that were known or had names behind them and had a lot of experience, I would sell my work for a lot less. I would sell my work for a lot less, and I would downplay my own worth in the conversations that I have with the customers. And even to the point where I'd point out mistakes of my work and basically talk myself out of sales.
Bad salesperson.
Yeah. And so what I kind of learned, though, is that, you know, a lot of people wouldn't buy my work. And I asked somebody that was really interested in my work. They were a friend of mine. And so I felt comfortable enough to ask them. And I said, you know, you passed on my piece here. I said, but I feel that it's executed a little better than the piece that you bought down the way. And I understand that art's subjective and it touches people in different ways. And so something that may not catch your eye in my booth is going to catch your eye somewhere else. But I felt comfortable enough asking him. And he said, well, when I went to your booth, you told me all the things that was wrong with it, all the things that you messed up on. And then you sold it for next to nothing. And he said, and I really didn't want to pay for it. And he said, one, because you downplayed what it was. He said, the other reason is you don't have value in it yourself. And to me, I'm like, I do, you know, but just putting the number on it, I was looking at it like, well, if I sell anything, I'm successful. But what he was saying is that if I don't find value in my own work to put a price on it that reflects the work that went into it, then why should I expect others to? And so it kind of resonated with me, and I sat on it for a while. And so the next market we had, I put my prices like very high. And I said, well, this is what I'm going to sell it for. You know, I do have a job. I work full time as a garden coordinator. And I said, you know, I do this on the side, but I'm going to own the work that went into it. I'm going to own the time and what it meant to me to make these things. And I'm going to put a price on it. And if it sells, then great. And if not, I'm not feeding my children with this. And so the sales that I make off of my artwork, I'm able to do things with my kids. I'm able to give them a fuller life, take them on vacation, show them things that my parents showed me, and provide for them in a little bit better way than just by getting by, you know. And so if I sell it, great. And if not, I'll find another home for it later. And so what's interesting is I used to have collaborative booths with a friend of mine. And it was all to save money. So we would work on something together and we would put it out and we'd only have to pay half the price of the booth. And he said, well, you determine the cost of this. What do you want to sell it for? And I said, well, and it was a pot. It was a vessel that takes a lot of skill and there's not very many people that make them. And we made it together and I had painted it and there was over 40 hours worth of work in this vessel. And it's something that was rare. And so I said, well, I want $1,200 for this. And he got kind of upset with me. And he's more of the bread and butter, selling a bunch of things to make his living. And so he said, well, you're not going to make more than 60 bucks on it. Pay me half. And then whatever you make on it, you can, but you're probably going to go home with it. And he was really upset. And so I said, all right, cool. And so I put it out. And before the market even started, a gentleman came up to me and said, this is very rare. What is this? And I was explaining to him, you know, the process. And I kept in mind not to downplay my work. Yeah. And I told him, you know, this is how it does, how it's done. These are how many people still practice this. This is the history of it. And he said, well, how much are you asking? And so I only wanted 1200. So I told him 1500. And he said, well, I have 1100 right now, cash, and I'll pay it. He said, you can leave it at your booth and I'll come back for it later. And my friend's eyes like just got so big and his jaw dropped to the floor. And I mean, to me, that kind of just like cemented or solidified everything that guy had told me the time before. And if you find value in yourself, others will see that as well. And that doesn't just correlate to sales. It's value in your words and knowing what you're speaking is truth. And when you're presenting or sharing information to other people or educating them in whether it be the field or in life or in the arts, if you don't believe in yourself, they're not going to.
He is a very successful artist. Native American. And when he started out, and I know him quite well, it's very genuine, he would tell potential buyers perhaps where his artwork was not so wonderful and special. And he downplayed it, humility, you know, being fair. And at the same time, he realized very quickly that you have to show your worth. And as an artist, and that's what I thought was interesting. And by the way, this lesson is also mentioned by other guests. For example, Dr. Banton referred to that as well. But as an artist, and that's what I thought was an interesting comparison, it's not just the time that you spend on creating artwork. He referred to hours of research that he does before he creates something. And of course, his creativity, that's not something that you can simply learn. You have that, you built that over time. And he uses that as well. So that is an important lesson. And then finally, I want to add another lesson also from Jacob Butler. Address issues with solutions, not complaints. And his story is very powerful, things that he had to endure. But most importantly, the lessons he learned from that and how it changed him as a person to give back to his family and his community. So that's where I want to start with.
Thank you. And Robert, what are your top lessons?
Oh, come on, man. We've got 100 episodes under our belt. We've got thousands of, or 1,000 lessons. It's very hard to pick it, even though this was our homework and I did do it. I agree with all of Siva's. I think they're very powerful and he stole a couple of mine. So I'm going to have to change mine now on the go. But I want to point out the Ori Eisen episode, his second lesson. Really resonated with me. You know, the hardest thing to do is to do. And you have to think about that. And that was just brilliant. When he said it, I just sat back and went, yeah, it is.
How many of us said, I want to lose weight. I want to go to the gym. I want to treat my kids better. I want to have time for myself. How many of us thought about these things and said these things? It's so much difficult to do it. So if you ever wanted to write a book, write a podcast, write a blog, go volunteer. The hardest thing is to one day put it on your calendar and do it, like start. After you start, it's easy, but just keep thinking about it will never get you anywhere. So the hardest thing to do is to do.
Is that something that you have done your whole life, or was that also something that you learned over time?
I've learned over time that when I look at my notebook of all the things I ever wanted to do, and my calendar of what did I actually spend my time doing, that dissonance told me that if it's not set for a date and an hour, it will be in my wish list all my life. So I'm winking at you and at the audience to say, you want to go volunteer? put it on your calendar, just like the meeting with your boss and the meeting with your customer. Put it at Saturday at 11 a.m. that says, go do that thing. Like, block the time. Then you'll see that you'll start doing your dreams and living your dreams as opposed to just dreaming them.
So, I mean, Ori was very good. All these lessons were good, but that one is great.
Saying that Nike was onto something with the Swish logo, just do it.
Well, yeah, but they did it, you see, and that's his whole point. You know? The hardest thing to do is to do.
Should have been just did it then.
Just did it.
Yeah.
When I looked at one of my all-time favorites, which, you know, regular listeners will hear me talk about when I interview some guests, is Andrew Tyndale's This Too Shall Pass, because that's a truism. Everything will pass. So love that. I think it's so insightful and powerful as a lesson. It's just wonderful. There's a couple of others that I liked. One is from you, Jeff, and it's, again, true, but you have to think about it, is nobody's thinking of you. Nobody's thinking of you. They've got their own shit to deal with. They're not thinking of you. So don't take things personally. But let me just expand on one particular lesson that was brought up by two different guests. The first one who brought it up was Vikas Tikku. And he mentioned, I think it was his very first lesson. And it was mentioned by a guest Diana interviewed later on, Brett Gilliland.
Gilliland, yes.
Gilliland. So Brett also mentioned the same thing, which is what brought you here won't get you there.
Yes, you know, I tried to play with some interesting play on words in some of these lessons just to make them more interesting. Really what I mean by that is, and again, this is based on my own personal experience, but I suspect a lot of people in the audience will probably identify with it. Everybody has multiple inflection points in their life and their careers, some more than others, depending on how active a life that you've led. In my personal case, I've always found that when I reached that inflection point and I reflected on what were my goals for the future, what did I want to do for the next stage, I realized that almost invariably, I realized that the skill set that had got me to that stage of my life, that stage of my career, whatever it was, while it was still important for me to carry that forward, it was no longer sufficient to allow me to get to my next level of performance or next level of achievement. And I don't mean just in monetary terms, in just any terms that I had established for myself. So the ability to reinvent yourself or in part or in whole at multiple times during your life is quite important for sustained success, both mental and financial well-being over your career. Too many people get stuck doing the same thing over and over again, and eventually it becomes very boring. So the ability at appropriate times in your life to reach that inflection point, reassess and reset your goals, and then reset learning goals as well so that you acquire some new dimension to your skill set is quite important for long-term sustained growth in my mind.
So I'm about to give you 2 years of a master's program in one statement, okay? And here it is. All organizations are perfectly designed to get the results they get. That's from a guy named Arthur Jones. He said it that way. Many others have said other versions of it, but it's basically you get what you get because you put in what you put in. The thing that we built is what gives us today's result. And if we want to go to tomorrow's result, something better, something bigger, then we have to change. We got to keep learning. We got to keep growing. And so there are these stages in small businesses on the ones and threes of revenue. Turns out there's a pattern to it. And so when you grow your business from 30,000 to 100,000 in annual revenue, you go from side hustle to now I'm fully self-employed. That's a stage change. And there's new stuff that you have to figure out if you want to go from 100,000 to 300,000. That new stuff is how to sell more. And from 300,000 to 1,000,000, there's a new thing. And you have to figure out how to get consistent lead generation and how to fulfill on your product or service consistently. That's a new thing. And once you do it, you create this steady operation and you hit the $1 million mark. And there's a new stage change. And from the 1 to 3 and the 3 to 10 and 10 to 30, it just keeps happening. Unfortunately, it doesn't naturally happen. Like you have to work to keep going. But yeah, there's these natural, this is kind of phenomenon. Every time you triple in size, you max out what the current thing can do. And you've got to learn something new if you want to keep growing.
And that's a constant theme throughout a lot of our guests, which is never stop learning, to put it bluntly. Your skill set will only take you so far. If you are self-aware enough to understand that and to develop the skill set you need to take you further, then that's going to get you far in life. So what brought you here won't get you there is such a powerful thing to understand. And I think it's born out of self-awareness. If you're not self-aware, you're not going to get this lesson. So they're the ones that really resonated with me, Jeff.
Yeah. And to that point about that lesson that was brought up by both Vickers and Brett, what's interesting also is that we're seeing constant themes, you know, of the same lessons being told in different ways. And one of my favorite ways of telling that particular lesson was from David Redhill. And the way he told that lesson was, be a child over and over again.
Yeah.
So indeed, it's the same lesson that we're learning, but in told in different stories, through different stories, different experiences. And yet what we're learning, seeing all these different people tell the same, basically tell us the same lesson, but in completely different ways, is very reassuring. Next up, we have Diana. I know you've been relatively new to this project, but by all means, you have interviewed so many guests in just such a short time frame. What are your favorite lessons?
Mine, Jeff. Mine. No, I'm just... No,
that's why we love you, Diana.
No, I actually have three and one that I really want to highlight. So I'll go from, you know, highlighting Siba, your episode, lesson number three, where you talked about be who you are. Don't try to be a different person to impress someone else.
I learned a lot from my old boss in executive search. His first name was Chuck, and he was a very good man and very, very genuine. And at the same time, his language was very direct. And he showed me when I started working there over 20 years ago, that the little cartoon, and it's a little cynical, so I want to be careful when I say it like this in a podcast, but it showed a veteran recruiter talking to a rookie recruiter. And the idea was the veteran said, it's real simple. You have clients and you have candidates. They're both liars. Now, again, I don't go through life like that, please. I don't, right? By being so cynical. But there is something to say, as a recruiter in particular, I want to make that clear, it's not for every role, that we need to have a certain level of suspicion when it comes to our candidates and when it comes to our clients. Not to say that they're liars, that takes it too far, but it has to fit their needs and their strategy, et cetera, on both sides. For recruiters, we are kind of in the middle of that playing field. We have to accept the fact that that is happening. We cannot change that. We just have to be aware. And I remember, again, my previous boss, who with a very quiet voice would say, that's not going to happen. We keep an eye out on that whole process. And if something goes wrong as a recruiter, I take responsibility, not the candidate that perhaps at the last moment went somewhere else. We have to smoke that out. And sometimes you just have to expect that a person is not telling the whole story. What can I say? It doesn't mean they're blatant liars or bad people. They may not give you the whole story. And it happens quite a bit.
Okay. So in the recruiting world, I get it. And I understand why the theater would happen in a job interview. But how does this point work in real life outside of the recruiting field?
That's a fair question. I think we all have to accept, of course, that we are who we are. That's not going to change. We are the individuals that we are. And can I apply a Dutch saying, and I'll mention it in English, just act normal because you're crazy enough. And so if you think you're going to be perfect and you think this, come on. And I think that is part of course, be who you are and try not to impress someone, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's in life. It's not just in hiring for a job. In life, accept who you are. You can improve. You can go all kinds of directions. I'm not saying that you're stuck in that. But if you make yourself look more grandiose than what you really are, it'll come through. It'll show. That's the point. It'll show.
That resonated with me so much because it's, you know, I spent the majority of my formative professional years trying to be what I thought bosses wanted me to be, customers wanted me to be. And it wasn't until I figured out who my crazy, authentic self was that I actually started to get more engagement and more positive feedback. And I love one thing that you said, which was accept who you are and just act normal because your crazy is crazy enough. And I loved that. I loved that. And then the next one is Peter Thornhill, his number one lesson, which was you can succeed despite your education.
I failed my last year at high school. So I finished high school in 1964. I failed my last year. All my grades in all the subjects were below the class average. I left school and was a bit of a loose end. Anyway, my father got me a job as a sewing machine mechanic in a factory where they embroidered sheets and pillowcases. So I was an apprentice sewing machine mechanic. I lasted there for probably 6 or 7 months and decided I could cross that off my bucket list. Went, answered a newspaper advertisement. So ended up getting a job as a clerk with an insurance company, one of the leading insurance companies here in Australia. And the progress from there, met, married, changed jobs briefly to work for a General Motors car dealership. I doubled my income from $2,500 a year to $4,200 a year, saved up, took off on the working holiday, got a job in London as a clerk with the insurance company I'd worked for in Australia, then went to an employment agency, got a job with the Merchant Bank, Anthony Gibbs & Sons in London as a clerk. And that was the last time in 1972 that I have ever applied for a job. Every other job has come looking for me.
So about the education, so you transcended your limited education, I guess, is what I'm hearing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I actually, when I started work, I went back to night school and I ended up polishing off another 3 subjects. So I got the qualification and that was basically it. Never set foot in the university, but took off and worked hard. And as I say, a clerk, worked hard, got headhunted to go to another company, got headhunted to go to another company, got headhunted to change jobs, got headhunted to move to Sydney, got and it just went on and on.
And that resonated with me as well, because as the team knows, our viewers and listeners might not know, I didn't get my degree until later on in life. And for a very long time, that was an emotional hindrance for me because I thought I didn't have what it took to bring to the table because I didn't have that quote unquote piece of paper. So Peter Thornhill's take or philosophy on what that piece of paper means or what you can do with your life with or without it, that really resonated with me. But the highlight had to be for me, Brad Casper, number 6, leadership is not a title.
I think, and this is really targeting some of the younger people in the podcast community who might be starting their career. But regardless of whether you're starting or starting with a new company or starting over, leadership is such a powerful tool to have in your toolbox. And I honestly believe it is something that is very much learned. Even if you are at the bottom of the org chart, there are opportunities to demonstrate a leadership position or a leadership mindset. And I think it was P&G who really kind of put that model in my head that you can lead from anywhere at any time. You don't have to be at the top of the org chart. And I would just encourage our listeners to think about that somewhere today, no matter which company they're in, they can demonstrate a leadership mindset that maybe is unexpected but it won't be unwelcomed. And I just wanted to make sure I shared that lesson with everyone. I would say that assuming that someone wants to accelerate their career, and again, depending, it almost is independent of which industry or sector you're in, if you demonstrate leadership, there's going to be an excellent opportunity for you to advance your career and grow. Yep. Conversely, if you don't demonstrate leadership, it's very hard to get not only promoted, but to certainly, you know, galvanize an entire team behind you. So leadership to me is the most important single attribute, along with integrity.
And all three of these lessons kind of go together, but that one brought it full circle because throughout my entire professional career, in one shape or another, I have been looked at to lead. And not because I asked for it. It's just, I guess, my eau de cologne. I don't know what it is, right? But I often passed up those opportunities and didn't speak up and lead because I felt, again, who would listen to me? I don't have that piece of paper. Who would listen to me? I'm a one-trick pony. I only know retail. And so that was very enlightening to me that what I thought to be true, why is everybody looking at me for the answer? I'm just sitting here trying to eat a bagel. What's going on? That it was because there are certain qualities that you may have about you that just are leadership qualities. And it has nothing to do with education or title. You're just seen as a leader. And so that resonated with me. So those are my three.
Yeah, and totally agree with those. I, you know, like you, I wish I knew Siba earlier on in my career because I can certainly have done with a lot of his advice.
This is very true. Siba, you are very well respected in the 10 Litsons family.
Well, that is so kind, but kind of scary because I'm not the wisest person on this podcast, but I'll take it. I think, and talking again to our guests and the lessons we learn, we're talking about people all over the world, and they all have experiences and lessons that they learn. And yet, through our podcast, we see certain wisdoms, of course, but also similarity. There is a message in there. And that is something, now that we are at the 100th episode, that we can look at that and say, there is a certain consistency. And yes, there's more to be done. We're not done with our mission. But it is very nice to see that. And look, we can all learn from each other. Let there be no doubt.
Indeed, Siba. And that just reminds me of another lesson from Dillard Jest. If you think you're wise, you're probably not.
Exactly. Exactly.
So we'll never stop learning. So over to my favorite team member who we've never got to see on camera, E. I know.
No, before you go to E, I take objection to that. Your favorite team member. What are the rest of us? Ham sandwiches? That's not
no, but you've
really
been on camera.
Hey, I'm going to step in and say that he is actually our favorite team member because viewers and listeners, when you see social media and you see us posting and you see all of the different tiles and topics and great nuggets of wisdom on social media, that is Mr. Wang right there.
And absolutely.
So we thank you very much. We wouldn't be where we are without this man. So you are the favorite. We love you, Robert. We love you.
I will second that. Yi's efforts have helped us reach our 100th episode. And without Yi working tirelessly in the background, getting us known, getting us out there, we would still probably be at 100th episode, but nowhere near with as many listeners and viewers as we have today.
Absolutely.
So thank
it's
you.
Very, very humbling to hear all of that, guys. Look, I think, you know, certainly it's great to be in front of the camera for a change. You know, the work we do really resembles teamwork, right? We are scattered around the world. You know, I am very fortunate to be working with you guys and to be part of this really amazing project. And I think that sort of, you know, really leads to my first lesson that I felt really strongly about. That is Ori Eisen's lesson number one. That is, you can do anything if you don't care who gets the credit.
You can do anything you want as long as you don't care who gets the credit. If I want to give soccer balls to kids all over the world, I can't go and do it myself. Physically, I can't. So I can either choose to, I want the credit for giving it to them, or I'm going to allow other people to get the credit for doing it. So the things get done, but it's not about me anymore. I've learned this lesson from Colin Powell. And when I heard the words for the first time, I honestly didn't really understand what they mean. But every year since then, I've taken this lesson to heart. I can now do anything, and you as a listener can do anything as long as you don't put yourself in the center. It's that simple. If the motivation is to get credit, you can do some things, but they will be limited. But the lesson is, you can do anything if you don't care who gets the credit. So yeah, it's all about the choice. Do you want just to get credit for the things you are able to do? And you can keep it doing that. But if you want to do bigger, grander things, you can, as long as you don't insist that you get the credit for every single thing.
And I think that speaks volume of what we do as a team. Yeah, you know, I don't know how, but we just somehow get together every week, bootstrapping with what we have and keep going. And I think that that itself is really needs to be commended for. And I think a lot of those efforts don't really get, you know, seen from our listeners, from our followers. And then it sort of leads to my second lesson, you know, and I've been reflecting this a lot. And I think it is a common theme coming out of lots of the lessons that we have is about self-awareness, is about introspection. And it's also about understanding, you know, what is the value that we hold dear. And I think one thing that is bonding us together as part of this team is that we have this really strong common shared beliefs and values, right? And it is in our mission statement. You know, we talk about this pretty much every week. I think knowing those values and knowing what they are is really important. And I think there's no other lesson better summarizing that than David Redhill's lesson number two, your values are your best guide.
Yeah, well, that was a political situation I got myself into. As a result of being the editor of the Journalism Review, I was offered a job in a potential cadetship in a large news corporation, one of Australia's biggest privately owned businesses. And I won't go into the details of who was involved or the owners, but at that time, the ABC, our national broadcaster, was cash strapped. And the suggestion being made by this news organization was that they provide their own journalists around the world, their stringers, as a sort of a syndicated provider to the ABC. And I felt very passionately as a journalist that the ABC should retain its independence, and it shouldn't, once it started taking news reports from private company journalists, there was a conflict of interest. So at the same time as applying for this job and in conversations with this news organization, I wrote a feature article in the Journalism Review condemning this, challenging this notion that this same news organization should be offering this route. And of course, it cost me the opportunity to get a job with the organization in question. So it was pretty naive in one respect to sort of write an article attacking the organization I was applying for a job at. But Jeffrey, it really didn't sit right with me. As a matter of fact, I didn't get that job, but another better door opened up for me. And in fact, I took a job in a hardware company, one of the first large computer companies and organization in Australia. I learned all about technology in the birth of the digital age from the ground up. It didn't hold me back as a journalist. It was the best first opportunity, first job I could have had. And I never looked back. I never regretted it. So my learning again was, if it doesn't feel good or sit right with you, then don't compromise your principles or cut corners to get ahead. You know, hard work and integrity in that work will get you where you're meant to go. And you'll be able to sleep at night. You'll be able to live with it. So that was a, you know, a profound learning. It was one of those sliding doors moments, Jeffrey. I could have gone that way, and I elected not to, and I went in a very different direction that I've never regretted.
And you know, that itself is, you know, is really important to me. And more specifically, if you think about it, we heard Sheriff Penzone talk about respect. Yeah, Rob, you talked about respect yourself. Diana, you mentioned Peter Thornhill. He talked about the can-do attitude. That is a great value to have. Siba, you talked about, you know, integrity a lot, right? Lagia McLean, as I remember, she talked about, you know, being resilient. These are just some examples of fantastic values that we all feel, you know, resonating, and we are upholding them ourselves. And it leads to sort of the standout lesson for me is Dr. Belle Leanne and Mr. Tim Klein's lesson number four, which is at value as a trailblazer or builder or champion or guardian.
Yeah. And just to dive deeper, because I think you gave a great example, those entrepreneurs that you're working with, they're individualistic, right? Because they want to go out and do their own thing, and they're growth oriented at the same time. They want to change it. And that's what we call trailblazers, where trailblazers are people who want to go their own way, blaze their own paths, and they want to create new things outside of existing systems. And they don't want to be told what to do. They don't want to be beholden to structures they don't want to agree with, right? And so those are trailblazers. And then what we found is that when you start a new entrepreneurial idea, at some point, that idea needs to be codified, and you need to start creating systems and processes. And what that happens is that you need to go find what we call builders. And builders are people who are growth oriented. They think change is a good thing, but they're collectivists at the same time, where they come in and they're like, you know what? We need to start creating systems and processes because we care about every single person in this organization, and we want it to work better for everyone. So we're going to come in and build these systems. And then what happens is that when you build these systems, you're like, okay, we have product market fit. The wheel is turning. We need to pour gasoline on the fire here and really go. Then what you actually need is you need what we call champions. And champions are individualistic and they're stability oriented. They actually like, they want to go out and individual achievement, recognition is what they want, but they want stability. What they want to know how the rules work so that they can optimize their own performance based on it. And they don't want to change the game at all, because if you change how systems work, that might interfere with their own individual performance. And then the final thing you need is what we call guardians, who are stability oriented and collectivists. And these are the people who want to protect and preserve what's tried and true. And these are the people who like, they want to protect what makes that organization special in the first place. And so what's interesting, it's knowing what your own individual value archetypes are, but then it's like a really, really high functioning organization has an equitable mix of all four of those value archetypes.
Absolutely.
Because, right? And so, but it's just being able to explicitly say that and then make sure, and then it's just, where do all the pieces fit there? So.
Good point. Belle, do you have anything to add to that?
Just the fit between, I like to put it as the way in which an individual can feel a cultural value add to an organization is very important. And so this chapter is about not only identifying your own as a worker, as an employee, as a manager, as a leader, your value archetype, but it's organizations identifying their value archetype or departments identifying their value archetype. So they can have a clear sense of what is going on in the dynamic when they might be in a guardian stage of the organization, or they may be, you know, just guardian focused, you know, really preserving what is tried and true. And they're feeling irritated by the trailblazers who are amongst them trying to push the envelope. So recognizing that, oh, like these people are not trying to make me miserable. They are living their archetype and bringing to our organization exactly what we need to balance our guardian archetype. So we think it's just so important for people to recognize what individuals are bringing into their organization rather than be threatened by the differences.
Really enjoyed that lesson because it's one of those frameworks that these guys came up with based on their research, but connected the values, personas, and to actions, right? So that they've got this nicely drawn value continuum, if you like, where everybody can be placed onto that continuum and really understand why someone would be saying something or doing something, you know, why they make decisions the way that they did, why sometimes they do one thing that is in contrary to what they say, for example. Right. And I think from a people leader perspective, it certainly helped me a lot in being cognizant about putting together a team that is balanced, you know, harnessing the differences so then we can have a collective strength to deal with the challenges that we have.
Well said, Ian. And I'd just like to acknowledge you also as our number one fan. It's pretty clear that out of all of us, you're the person that has the most intimate knowledge of all the lessons.
I do listen to all of them as much as I can.
Yeah. And the passion in the content truly shows. So thank you very much, Ida. I really appreciate that insight into those lessons. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was asked what were my top lessons for in preparation for this discussion, it was a very difficult choice because there's so many I agree with. But then I thought I'd have a bit of fun with it. I went for lessons that I felt that I needed to do more, like as in lessons that I could take away and practice. So a highlight for me started very early on in this journey. Andre Alfonso's lesson number 3, banish psychic vampires.
I used to work with a guy about 15 years ago. And we used to run workshops. So I used to run a training company. And he'd often come back and go, oh, I said, how was the workshop, Garrett? And he goes, it was fantastic, except for a couple of psychic vampires in the room. and you know what I mean? It's those, if those of you who've been in the classroom would know exactly what that is. It's those people that kind of suck the energy out. They're negative. They're mismatches. They don't want to be there. They're cynical. So, you know, those are the psychic vampires. And I've realized as I've gone through life that I've kind of let a lot of them into my life. And I find that, you know, they used to suck. the energy out of
it. In so many ways.
Oh, man, they suck. And again, this is probably one of the hardest things I've had to do, which is about making sure I limit or banish those relationships that, and it could be from clients, it could be from colleagues, it could be for people who work for you, it could be friends, and it could even be family members at some stage. They're not immediate family, but usually extended family members, right? Mm-hmm. Where you just feel this energy, you know, they leave and you go, I just want to shoot myself. It's like, no. And life is too short. I don't want that in my life. I don't want people, you know, making me so, you know, your personal solar system at one hand brings out the very best in you. Psychic vampires actually bring out the very worst in you. Mm-hmm. And I think banish them, get rid of them, move them out. You know, my boss once said to me, there's a guy I used to work with a long time ago, work for me. And he was just one of those, you know, he'd show up late for meetings. If he was sitting there, he'd be looking at the newspaper in our sales meetings. He'd be mismatching everything. If you say blue, they would say gray. You know, everything was sinister. That's not going to work kind of approach. And it was just bringing everyone down. And eventually he had to go. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to my boss at the time and saying, look, here's the situation. This is the guy. He's bringing the whole team down. And, you know, we're just not being able to hit our straps. And I remember what he said to me. He said, Andre, no breath is better than bad breath. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of that phrase is stuck in my head for some reason for a long time. And I think that's it. Banish psychic vampires. Get them out of your life.
Oh, yeah. So psychic vampires are sort of the negative, the people who suck their energy out of the room and, yeah, just negativity all around. And unfortunately, I recognized upon some reflection that probably kept a few psychic vampires around. So look, practicing it was difficult, but it was definitely something that I appreciated learning. Now, another lesson I had a lot of fun with was with Mr. Jim Carroll, lesson number 9, beware of the noisy, self-absorbed few. Yeah. So the context of that lesson is that there are people who tend to get an outsized amount of attention, but they shouldn't be occupying as much as they should. And I think it takes courage to ignore or shut down those people who are very, very loud. And that's certainly something, I can't say I'm there, but it's something I'm practicing in my life to make sure that I, you know, make space for those people that we should make space for. But the highlight for me was Andrew Tyndale's lesson number 3, the wise man built his house on the rock and not sand.
As you become more intentional in your imaginations and in your planning and in your playing the long game, this is about investing in yourself. It's about investing in your character and the true foundations of your life, not investing in your profile or your CV or your number of followers or the level of influence that you have. It's not about that. All those things are transitory. The only thing that's permanent for you is the character that you build in yourself. So I encourage you to invest in character, not in personality, not in profile. So when I say character, I mean building the value set that you know is going to be important to seeing you through. And that can be everything from integrity to resilience to honesty to innovation. All the values that you believe are important for you, treating people well, those kinds of things. That inner investment and the disciplines that you build around that are one is going to set you up for future success. In 10 years, nobody's even going to remember what LinkedIn is, much less how many followers you had. That is not what you invest in. And it's not about the fashion that you wear or the products that you use. This is about who you are becoming as a person. If you're building a house, for example, build the foundation. Don't build a nice paintwork. Don't invest in painting over cracks. Strip it away, strip it right down to the foundation and make sure the foundation is built on rock before you start building up everything else. I guarantee you that you're going to go through good times and I guarantee that you're going to go through hard times and probably multiple times. In that last exercise, the Campbell exercise, you're likely to have a working life of 60 to 80 years. Well, that's 6 or 8 careers of 10 years each. So what you want to do is you want to build the foundations of your skills and of your character. And when the bad things happen, which they will, what will stand the test of time is your character. What won't stand the test of time is all the superfluous stuff, all the temporary things, the fluffy things that you thought were important, like the fancy car you drove or the clothes that you wore or the holidays you took. That's garbage. That will be washed away in a storm. If you build your house on the rock, it'll survive whatever comes your way.
And that sounds pretty profound, but what Ed's talking about is pursuing character rather than something more flimsy like reputation or fame or other things. And so that was a profound lesson for me precisely because I recognized in my own life I was pursuing the wrong things for probably a bit too long and not the difficult things that will ultimately define who I am. And so that's something, again, another work in progress, but it had a real profound impact in understanding what was ultimately more important. So these are the lessons that I took the most out of. And, you know, I'm hoping if you haven't listened to them, please go and check them out. So now the fun part of today.
Hang on a second, Jeff, just on that, on what you've just said, the one thing that you brought up in your interview, which demonstrates your belief in what you've just said, was that you said, don't chase happiness, chase fulfillment. And I think there's a subtle difference, but building your house on the rock as opposed to the sand is fulfillment, is helping you find that fulfillment. I mean, it's the same metaphor that goes for business strategies as well, but let's put that aside. If we're talking existential now, definitely following fulfillment. And this is what I learned also from you, because I'd never actually thought of it that way. And I see what you're saying. And I just want to point that out, that you are living what you are saying. You're actually a man of action and not just a man of words.
Oh, thank you, Rob. And I could clearly say that I plagiarized that from Andrew and Dr. Jordan Peterson. I did mention that in the interview, but thank you for pointing it out, Rob.
We'll take a little break now, and we'd like to thank our affiliate partner, Audible. Audible is an amazing way to consume 10 lessons learned and other content like books and other podcasts, allowing you to build a library of knowledge all in one place. You can start your free, yes, I said free, 30-day trial by going to audibletrial.com/10lessonslearned. With Audible, you can find your favorite lessons while at home or on the go. Once again, that's audibletrial.com/10lessonslearned for your free 30-day trial. The link we'll put in the show notes. Back to you, Jeff.
Thank you. But as I was alluding to before, the fun part of today, was there any lessons in the 1,000 or so lessons that we've had that didn't work for you? You know, so lessons that you might know or might hear a lot out there, but through your personal experience, that it's just not quite useful, or it may be the wrong context. I'll throw it out there. So, Siba, is there any particular lessons that you find that you either disagree with or just didn't?
You know, it's interesting because we all realize how difficult it is to select the lessons that we really like because there are multiple. So to find a lesson that perhaps did not work for me, I had to look closely. And also, you know me well, with respect for our guests, it's not to say I don't like this, I don't like this person at all. No, I picked Guillaume Lucci, lesson number 4, you lead by listening. Now, Guillaume is a highly respected individual. I don't know him personally, but I think highly of him, a CEO of an infrastructure company, very successful. But the reason that I specifically took that lesson, you lead by listening, because look, we all realize listening is important. Yes. But what do you do with that information? And just listening doesn't solve much. It will help create clarity in, let's say, in my head when I listen to someone. Unless I take action, there is nothing that I do with it. Yeah, I can make some internal changes myself based on what I heard, but I don't agree with the fact that you do lead with listening. And that's the element I picked on that lesson. And I think if I would have the opportunity to talk to Mr. Lucci, I'm sure we would work that out. But I think it's important that people realize that listening by itself is not necessarily the solution. And again, in my definition, it doesn't create leading the conversation or whatever you are working on. Just listening is not enough.
See, isn't that interesting? Because I heard a different meaning in that lesson when he spoke. So that's the beauty of this show. You get out of it what you get out of it. Yeah, if it resonates with you, if it doesn't resonate with you. Now, I understand your point, Siba, but it's interesting that I didn't see it that way.
Yeah, I think all the lessons have a backstory. And I think, you know, all our guests took a lot of times in coming up with those 10 lessons and the backstory behind them. So I think the importance of this conversation is not so much about what do we agree and disagree. It's about how we interpret those lessons differently. Right. So I might just dive in, and Jeff, if you don't mind, because I've got a lesson that didn't quite work with me, or, you know, I sort of interpreted it a different way. That is a sort of on the opposite side of what Siba said. This is lesson number one. Don't worry about what other people are thinking about you, from Ambassador Niels McQuad. You know, in this conversation, Rob, you interviewed him. I actually agree with the notion that people are not thinking about you, right? Most of the time. It is absolutely unhealthy to have this habit of trying to guess, second guess, you know, overinterpret what other people may think of you. Perhaps it's not really explicit in this lesson, but that's how I felt was that I do disagree with the notion that, you know, self-compassion is equal to being totally comfortable with ourselves, right? The whole package, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I think that itself particularly is not helpful for those who are, you know, overly self-critical, for example. You know, one thing I've noticed over the last couple of months as we emerged out of the pandemic, as we, you know, getting back into more in-person social setting, is that we've seen a sort of new breed of people really focus on their individual needs, right? You know, they probably got into the habits over the last 2 years of lockdowns and isolation to really think about themselves, and at times really placing themselves ahead of others. You know, the teams they're working, the people around them. So yeah, and yeah, you know, and it's not just the young, the Gen Z, so to say. I see that across the age group. So I think, you know, we are social animals. You know, we live in a social setting. The environment that are we in and how people think shapes the social norm, what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. So I think one and everyone should be observant to all of that. And you can't have it all the way, you know, for yourself. And certainly it's not right to disregard the considerations that we should naturally extend to other people.
So I actually don't disagree with that. I think, you know, coming from a collective, a society, you tend to realize that, you know, that it's important to take the group into account. However, that particular lesson, I think the context is a little bit missing in that. I think the focus here about him not just reading into something what's not there, and it's about communicating and actually finding out what they really mean. So I think you're both right in that regard, but I suppose the wording of that lesson might lead someone to think that it's, you know, it's not important to live within the context of the collectivist value and to fit into a society and try and, you know, do the right thing by the society. So I think it's important to distinguish, you know, probably wasn't what he meant by that lesson. Yeah. But yeah, I take your point. So let's go with Diana. Now, I think, yeah, this will be interesting. What was a lesson that you find that didn't work for you?
So while there are certain points of this lesson that I do agree with, and I'll talk about those, I think the actual wording of the lesson itself for a global audience, it didn't work for me. And that is, respectfully, Megumi Miki. I loved the episode. I thought it was amazing. Jeff, you did such a wonderful job. But her lesson number, I think it was 3, racism, sexism, and other marginalizing forces are real, but you can choose not to be a victim to them. So in a certain sense, I agree with certain things that she said within that construct, right? Which is, one of them was, and I love this, hope for the best, prepare for the worst, right? Kind of how I live my life. But, you know, I grew up in the Bronx in New York, and viewers and listeners, if you've not noticed, I am a woman of African American descent. And sometimes in my culture, in my community, choosing not to be a victim or choosing to ignore or have you want to lead it could get you killed. And that's a very serious thing. And I don't know that it's a global thing. I know only from my experiences here in America, but the way the lesson was worded for me was particularly disconcerting, because there are some times in life where these things cannot be ignored. And you don't have a choice as to whether or not you're a victim. You are the victim. You are going to be marginalized. Now, in the context that she spoke about, you know, in the workplace, and knowing that when you walk into a room, if you are a female, they may not expect that you are the one in charge, or you would be the one that would have the information, right? I totally understand that. And that has happened to me on several occasions. But then I'll also go a little farther and say that we also have these very bad labels that we put on different races that marginalize us in different ways. And so, yeah, we as a team have had conversations about how, you know, how African Americans are perceived in the US, and you know, what is the first thought that comes to your mind about their work ethic, about what they bring to society? And then there's a different perception for the Asian community in America, right? And so having that understanding of saying, hey, yes, I'm a woman of Asian descent, and they may not understand that I am leading this project or I am the owner of this company, but they're going to, at any event, they're going to think, well, maybe I'm good at math, you know, that old adage, right? There's nothing like that in the African American community, right? There's not, oh, well, maybe she's good at singing, or maybe he's good at basketball, right? And I'm being facetious for a reason, because there are different labels for different people. And I just, while in the context of the lesson, as she spoke about it, you understood what she meant, that sentence by itself, I think, is a little bit misleading. And that's why it didn't quite work for me.
Yep. And I agree with that. One thing that came to light is that once you have an international audience, you realize that the cultural context is incredibly important to everything we discussed. And thanks for bringing that to our attention, Diana. This is actually not the first time we discussed the context of this lesson. What's interesting is that even with that context, there's something that I think we can still take out of that lesson. For her, is about not giving up. It's about not just, you know, you don't just stop trying just because you're in a position of disadvantage. And I think that's universal to all. And certainly understanding the limitations to your perceived biases is incredibly important for you to be able to overcome them. And I think so that makes a really useful lesson in that regard. So thanks for that contribution, Diana.
But isn't that what we're all about? That
right.
You take out of what we give you, what we bring to you, what you take out of it, and you apply it within your sphere, within your life, within your community, if that's what you want to do. And that's exactly what Diana did. You know, this bit does not work. This bit works.
Right. So, and even when you were talking about the resilience, Jeff, I chuckled a little bit, because I'm like, if anybody can talk about resilience, it's the African-American community. It's in our DNA. We have to be resilient. But we are in heightened survival mode every single day of our lives for how many generations now? Over 400 years. And so, yes, Robert, so impactful. And I feel like some lessons that, you know, that maybe going forward, we should have lessons that don't necessarily work for us, but a disclaimer. This is why, and it's still a good lesson.
Yeah.
And these are the things you can get from it. But here's how I see it from my lens.
Well, isn't that our job as hosts? Aren't we supposed to do that in front of the guest? I hope I try to do that. I know that, Siva, you've done it sometimes.
Yeah, and it is our job. But we do have our blind spots too, mind you. You know, and through this experience, I've sort of come away wiser for it.
That's one of Siva's lessons,
I was going to say, that's one of my lessons. But I think this is such a relevant point, Diana, that you're making. And you also touched on it because you notice the global element and global discussion. Racism is wrong under all circumstances, let there be no doubt. At least that's my opinion. It doesn't matter which country, doesn't matter what part of the world. But indeed, the experience that people have, and you know, it has been indeed a lesson, an experience for me as a white guy moving to the United States. If I look at the lack of respect for certain races within the United States. It is painful. It is painful. And sure, in this country, United States, we can point at the progress that has been made. And yes, we can point at certain areas, of course, but it is still an awareness that people have. And I'm aware that the awareness is there, and it is pretty amazing. In our podcast, of course, our guests, we are from different parts of the world. We talk with guests from all over the world. We talk about topics that impact certain countries, certain cultures more directly than perhaps other countries. And I think, again, that is the beauty of our podcast. And that's why, yes, 100, but we're on our way to 200 and who knows, 300, right? Because there is so much more to learn from our guests and to share with our global audience. So I'm very glad that, Diana, that you brought this up because it's relevant for all of us, for all of us.
That leads to a lesson that I did not resonate with me. It's along the same lines as this. So it's a good segue, actually. And it was from Brad Casper. Now, Brad's great, right? We loved his episode. But Brad said something that just did not fit with me. Treat everyone as you wish to be treated. It's not going to happen. There are people out there who don't want to be treated the way I want to be treated. And I think we've just touched on that culturally, value-wise, a whole range of reasons why you don't treat or you shouldn't treat people the way you want to be treated, because they're not you. You're not them. They're different from you. Recent guest Keith Rowe, I had a great anecdote about this as well. But this is the whole point. If you start treating people the way you want to be treated, you're projecting your values onto them. And therefore saying, well, I would like to be treated this way. Why aren't you treating me this way? And you're ignoring or dismissing their cultural relevance for that situation. I can give you examples, but I think the point is very clear. So as much as I like Brad and everything you had to say, this particular lesson just rubbed me up the wrong way.
And I don't think Brad would disagree with you, to be honest. I think it's showing respect, right? If you expect to be respect, I think that's what I kind of got out of there.
Yeah, and so, I agree with that.
It's the old adage of do unto others, right? That is treating another person with the same level of respect and human kindness that you would expect, but I agree with you, Robert. It shouldn't go as far as treating people the way I wanted to be treated because, you know, hey, if I were able to do that and everybody in society that interacted with me reciprocated in kind, there would be no lengthy conversations. It would just be, I'm a get to the point kind of person. Don't waste my time. And so you'd have a whole bunch of people in the world going around saying, did you do it? Okay, great. See you tomorrow. Bye. Like, that's not...
You know what? That wouldn't be... That might not be a bad thing, Diana.
Sounds kind of good.
But I see exactly what you're saying. But I know it came from a place of that do unto others, which is more of a treating people with human respect, humanity, as opposed to treating them the way you want to be interacted with.
You made an excellent point because I think that proverb is meant to be that. Love and respect, not... You know, say please, not, you know, button up your shirt, pull your pants all the way up, don't have them hanging down, kind of garbage that people are putting into that now. It's not a matter of, you know, treat other people the way you want to be treated in society. It is exactly what you've both just said, or the three of you have just said, treat people with love and respect the way you want to receive that love. And I think that transcends culture, that transcends everything.
Agreed.
Yeah. And like, if we were to have a go at rewriting that lesson, we probably would have said, treat everyone the way they want to be treated.
Yeah.
And it could be, you know, same lesson, but just in a much more universal way. So, well, leads me to the lesson that didn't quite work for me. Now, an honorable mention was Juiced Nikki Lusterberg, lesson number 9, be a shit screen.
Love it.
As much as I love that idea, I just get a feeling that it might not work out so well for me.
But go ahead.
That was just tongue in cheek. But the lesson that I feel like doesn't work for me, as much as I loved the person that was being interviewed, Dr. CJ Cornell. Lesson number four, he said, if you have to tell me how great you are, you're not. And as much as I love the idea for that to be true, the lived experience, and this is with a cultural context of an Asian person who's generally humble living in the West, if you don't go out and tell everyone about what you've done and what you've achieved, then you're most likely going to get ignored. You know, in the Western world, self-promotion is just a part of life. It's just part and parcel of life. If we don't do that, you're going to be at a distinct disadvantage. You know, I remember going into an interview and I said, we did this. It just rubbed the interviewer the wrong way. You know, they want to know what I did. And I was just completely uncomfortable claiming credit for something that the team has achieved, even though I knew that without me in that room, we would not have achieved it. Yeah. That's really what they were asking for. So again, not disagreeing with the nature of the lesson, I want it to be true. I just don't think it is the way the world is in reality. And, you know, and unfortunately, that's just the cultural context that we live in.
Jeff, you hit the nail on the head. I think that's great. But it's funny because I just did second to recent episode, Ron Higgs kind of said the same thing, which is, you know, if you should not be calling yourself the expert, it's your peers that give you that title. And that's when you know you've made it, right? And I think that what CJ was trying to get across in a way is if you spend too much time puffing yourself up and talking about what you do, what you've done, how does anybody actually get to see you in action? If you're so busy promoting yourself, how do we see you actually in action? So give me action and let me see how great you are. But you're absolutely right, in these larger organizations where you can get lost and you may or may not be a minority and it may not be in your culture to actually toot your own horn. Will you ever get noticed if you don't say these things? You know, if you just put your head down and do, because unfortunately, at least in American society, I can't speak for Australia, a lot of the times, the squeakiest wheels get the most attention. And the people that put their heads down and do the good work, they're taken for granted because there are no fires there, which is really, it's supposed to be the opposite, really, trying to build a healthy organization. But I get exactly what you're saying. And I've been in the same situation that you just gave that example of me saying the team and my boss looking at me saying, well, what about you? What did you do? And I actually, I remember this so clearly. I said, I was here cheering them on, giving them the right direction so that they can do the things that I just told you they did. And that's my claim to fame. And that's what brings me joy. And Siba, you as an executive recruiter, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, there's a lot to it. I keep coming back, and in a recruiting situation again, you know, we're talking about business environment. If you think about personal life, how you go through life, and you think of children or other family members, do we apply the same values as we do in a business environment when we talk to our boss or we talk to colleagues or we're managing people? So there are so many elements to all of the lessons that we talk about. And I think that leaves room for interpretation. And so that's not a good answer to your specific question, but I would always then say, well, it depends. What are we talking about? But in general, I would say, you know, obviously understanding, becoming aware of people, behaviors, situations, that is part of the mission that we are all on. And I think that is something that will push us to continue in our podcast and to find guests. Definitely want to mention as well that we have had so many guests that after the recording came back to us, right? You know what I'm going to say. And they said, well, thank you for making me think about my lessons. And thank you for making me or allowing me to share these lessons. And I think that's another element that we need to consider as far as how we actually can help our guests in this particular program.
I agree. But also going back to it, you talked about professional and personal. If I'm at a bar and somebody walks up to me and he says, I'm the best boyfriend you'll ever have, I'm creeped out.
I would say yes.
You know, yeah. So again, it's still.
I think you speak for every person on this planet. If someone walked up to you in a bar and said that, you'd be creeped out.
But again, self-promotion, you know, even if I'm in the supermarket and the cashier's ringing everything up and I'm saying, wow, she's really fast, but I don't mention anything to her or him. And all of a sudden they look up at me and say, you know, I'm the best cashier this side of the West. I'll be like, well, weird flex, but okay. You know,
well, I think you nailed you hit the nail on the head before when you said it depends, right?
It does. It does.
You mentioned there was a proverb saying that the squeakiest wheel get the grease. But in some contexts, in some cultures, the loudest duck gets shot. So it depends.
Well, I'll add one last thing to this. And that is a lot of the people who blow their own horn are talking about things that happened in the past.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Think about that, because if you're going to spend, you know, everyone's time telling them how you were great 5 years ago or 3 years ago, this is an idea you had when you were 20, who cares? Quite frankly, who cares?
Yeah. And on that note, we will finish as we look forward into our next 100 episodes. You've been listening to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we dispense wisdom for career, business, and life. Don't forget to leave us a review or comment. You can even email us at podcast@10lessonslearned.com. That's podcast@10lessonslearned.com. Go ahead and hit that subscribe button so you don't miss an episode of the only podcast that makes the world a little wiser, lesson by lesson. Thanks for listening and stay safe, everyone.